welcome to St. Anthony's. My name is Pascal Minori. I'm the Khaled bin Abdel Al Saud Professor in the study of the contemporary Arab world. I'm very happy, delighted to see you all here tonight. I'm even happier to welcome Dr. Ilham Fakhro to the center and to St. Anthony's. Thanks very much for being here. You're back to one of your multiple homes. You did your PhD here at St. Anthony's College after. And you also hold a LLM. What is an LLM?
It's a master's in law.
A master's in law from the Harvard Law School. And you're currently at Harvard. You're a research fellow at the Belfer Center, the Middle East Initiative at the Harvard Kennedy School. And you were also, prior to this, a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. And you were teaching at NYU Abu Dhabi and the University of Exeter. It's a pleasure to be here with you tonight. It's a pleasure to have you here. You're going to talk about your book, which you'll find copies of at the end of this session right outside the door. And I hear that you're going to sign some of them.
Happy to.
So the book is called The Abraham Accords, The Gulf States, Israel, and the Limits of Normalization. I started reading it yesterday night, and it's awesome. Thank you very much for being here. Please join me in giving her a round of applause.
Okay, let me make sure. Yeah, can you hear me? All right, so first of all, thank you so much to the Middle East Center and the organizers for having me here today, especially Eugene Rogan. I'm just so happy to be back in Oxford where I did my DPhil some years ago. And it's a great pleasure to be invited back here. I'll let you know a little bit about my choice of topic and how and why I wrote this book before getting into kind of the specifics. As Pascal noted, the title is the Abraham Accords, the Gulf States, Israel, and the Limits of Normalization. I began writing this in the summer of 2020. We were in the fourth or fifth month of the pandemic. I was teaching at NYU Abu Dhabi at the time. I was working at the International Crisis Group as well. And most things had moved online. It was the kind of time where really everybody was locked up in this pandemic. And out of nowhere, this tweet came out by President Trump, noting huge announcement today, capital letters, peace between our two great capital letters, friends, Israel and the UAE. And this came as a massive surprise, not only because we were in the middle of this pandemic, but because I think no observer or academic of the region could have predicted these agreements at the time. It was widely understood that there were covert ties between some Gulf states and Israel, but almost no indication that they were on the cusp of a public normalization agreement. 2 months later, these agreements were signed between Bahrain, the UAE, the United States, and Israel in Washington, D.C. The text of the agreements also said very little. They're about 3 to 4 pages long. They talked about a new culture of peace. They talked about a new culture, a new time of prosperity and trade. But for those of you who have studied the peace agreements between Israel and Egypt or Israel and Jordan, those were full of detail and annexes on ending the conflict between the two sides, on border issues, land issues, water issues. But because these countries had not been in an active state of conflict, there was none of that to talk about. It's just an outline of kind of their ambitions on this new chapter. Over the next few months, I began to carry out more field work and interviews to understand the significance of these agreements, and then spent 3 years writing the book at Exeter University after leaving the organization. The main focus of the book is not the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is now back into focus after October 7th, but more so on Arab-Israeli normalization in the years leading up to the war and its implications for the conflict. So what I'll do is begin with some history, not too much, to tell the story of Israel's relationship with the Gulf states and why it matters now. So if we go back to 1948, this was the year that Israel was founded out of the first Arab-Israeli war. As part of this, the mass expulsion of Palestinians resulted in 750,000 Palestinians had to leave their homes, 450 towns were emptied, and roughly 4,000 to 5,000 Zionists were also killed in this conflict, but it was basically a victory for the Zionist movement because it led to the founding of the State of Israel. For the purpose of the Gulf states and normalization, the next significant moment in the timeline is 1967, the third Arab-Israeli war. This is when Israel increased its landmass by 3 to 4 times by occupying the Golan Heights from Syria, the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt, as well as the West Bank and Gaza, which had been earmarked under the UN partition plan for the, as a future Palestinian state. Now, the Gulf states for the first time participated indirectly in this conflict in several ways. That year, Sheikh Zayed of the UAE, who would go on to found the UAE and unite it into a single country, sent humanitarian aid to support the Arab states that were fighting Israel in the conflict. Kuwait itself sent a contingent of troops that participated directly in the war under Egyptian command. After the conflict, the UN Security Council issued Resolution 242, which became the basis of international law on the conflict. And it stressed two things. The first is Israel's withdrawal from the occupied territories, but also the right of every state in the region to exist in peace. And this was meant to create a foundation for a settlement for Arab-Israeli peace through this exchange of land for peace. And it becomes the position that the Arab states take collectively, meant to be a collective position, land for peace. In 1973, we have the fourth Arab-Israeli war, and the Gulf states participate in an Arab oil embargo. They stop selling oil to the US and other states that support Israel in that war, and their role becomes pretty significant at this juncture as a source of economic pressure on the US and on Western states supporting Israel. After 1973, there's the beginning of a period of US-led diplomacy to resolve the conflict. And it's interesting that I think this is born partly out of the Arab oil embargo. Kissinger and others in the United States begin to see how the conflict can actually directly impact US oil prices and US interests in the region. And so it drives a real interest in resolving the conflict. In 1979, there's the first breakthrough with Egypt and Israel. Israel withdraws from the Sinai Peninsula in exchange for peace with Egypt. This is under President Carter. And then in Jordan in 1994, later on, there's a peace agreement between Israel and Jordan, which also is based partly on land for peace in the sense that the border areas between the two states are also finalized. I'll just take a bit of a break. By the mid-1990s, there's the Oslo process, and it looks like, as a result of this diplomatic process, that a Palestinian state may be on the horizon in the mid-90s. And this is where we see what I call in the book the first wave of Gulf normalization with Israel. Several Gulf states begin to open their doors to Israel, but this is done on the basis that a Palestinian state is in the works. So Qatar and Oman both set up preliminary trade offices to trade with Israel. Meanwhile, the UAE also begins to engage Israeli officials and diplomats behind the scenes in Washington at a time when it's looking to acquire F-16 fighter jets from the United States. And it engages in this kind of back-channel diplomacy with Israelis, asking them not to block the sale of F-16s in Washington. And for the UAE and the Gulf states generally, this really reflects the view that Israel is a useful interlocutor in Washington and a useful route to gaining more access and power in Washington. But what happens is the Oslo peace process collapses. There's no Palestinian state that's born out of this. And instead, there's a second intifada that emerges, which is a Palestinian uprising. And as a result, both Gulf states, Qatar and Oman, close their offices. And this is partly also the result of pressure from Saudi Arabia and Iran at the time. And this first wave of normalization totally collapses. In 2001, next, is the Arab Peace Initiative. This is a Saudi-led initiative that proposes normalization from 22 members of the Arab League. In exchange for an independent Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. Other conditions include the rights of return of Palestinian refugees, but no Israeli leader accepts its terms. And consistently until this point, I think even with the first wave of Gulf normalization, what we can see is that normalization is linked to Palestinian statehood. That remains the case. Things change, I think, very clearly in the year 2006. And there are four kind of events that bring the two sides into closer convergence. The first kind of reason for this is on the basis of again, two regional events. So what happens in 2006? It's the year that Iran announces the start of its nuclear program. It announces that it has enriched uranium for the very first time. as well, Hezbollah is seen to be victorious in its conflict with Israel in Lebanon. And these two events really do ring alarm bells in Saudi Arabia, in the UAE, and in Bahrain. The Gulf states begin to take even more seriously their competition with Iran and what they see as an expanding Iranian influence in the region, which also was triggered by the 2003 invasion of Iraq. That's the first kind of factor, is these events where Iran is seen to be ascendant. The second event that triggers a new convergence with Israel is the rise to power of a new generation of Gulf leaders. So I spoke about Sheikh Zayed, the founder of the UAE. He passed away in 2004, but he had been an ardent supporter of the Palestinians. He had donated for the construction of a massive housing complex in Gaza called Sheikh Zayed City, and he had provided much aid to the Palestinian leadership and UNRWA over the years. He's replaced by a younger leader who is less committed to the Palestinians, and eventually, I'll get to that later. The other change is in power is Sheikh Issa Bahrain. He also passes away a few years later, earlier, and is replaced by a younger king and crown prince. And these two figures are less committed to principles of Arab unity and Arab nationalism. They're less preoccupied by seeing the question of Palestine as central to the future of the Arab world. They are instead much more concerned by the regional rise of Iran, and they feel far more threatened by that. Bahrain, especially at the time, wants to be closer to the US, and that's a function of its very pro-Western crown prince, who is US educated, and who personally sees the deepening of the US security umbrella as crucial to Bahrain's survival. In 2009, he writes an op-ed in the Washington Post saying that there should be a dividend for states that are willing to take risks for peace. He describes the main fight in the Middle East as one taking place between extremists and between moderates who wouldn't have a problem with Israel. And this actually mirrors much of the Israeli discourse of the conflict, because it takes occupation out of the question and it frames it as a religious conflict between two religions. And following the publication of this op-ed, there's quite a bit of outrage in Bahrain over it. So that's factor number two, the rise to power of these new leaders who are really less committed to the cause. The third factor down the line is the Arab Spring. What we see initially out of the Arab Spring within the first year looks like the rise of Islamist governments in places like Egypt. There are emboldened populist democratic movements. And the Gulf states also begin to fear a loss of influence to these two currents that appear to be empowered across the region. And they feel that a changing regional order might also threaten their long-term survival. This view of kind of being skeptical of these movements and of Islamist movements is shared by Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, who compares the Arab Spring to the Iranian Revolution of 1979. So this shared threat perception is really the third factor that brings them closer together. The fourth and final factor is the signing of the JCPOA, or the Iran nuclear deal, in 2015. Both Gulf leaders, and I would say Gulf leaders from three states especially, it's really Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain, and those three together, express kind of a frustration that they haven't been included in these talks, that the talks or the agreements in its final form does not cover Iran's missile program, which they see as even more threatening than Iran's nuclear program. For Netanyahu, it's that these talks don't go far enough in preventing Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. He travels, of course, to the Congress and to the UN to make the case that this agreement is just not good enough. But this event also creates, I would say, the last factor for a strategic convergence between the two sides around this shared threat perception and a desire to influence US policy towards the region. I'll talk a little bit about Netanyahu and his approach. So for him, clearly, he's made the case that the JCPOA does not go far enough in eliminating Iran's nuclear program. Netanyahu had come to power in 2009, being very opposed to a two-state solution. He did not want to deal with the Palestinians at all, wanted to avoid that kind of diplomacy that might lead to a two-state solution. Instead, what he preferred was an outside-in approach, what is called peace for peace, based on this idea that if Israel strengthens itself economically and militarily, the Arab states will want peace for its own sake without any settlement for the Palestinians. Under his watch, unsurprisingly, the number of settlements reached 750,000 settlements by the year 2019, whereas there had been about 100,000 settlers during the peace process of the 1990s. So there's an explosion of settlers in the West Bank, which effectively create the conditions or remove the conditions for statehood, because it becomes increasingly impossible to create a Palestinian state in the West Bank simply out of a lack of land for its creation. Under Netanyahu, Israel's occupation becomes a permanent occupation that is effectively entrenched. And he also uses Hamas and Gaza as a pretext to stop talks with the Palestinian Authority. Under Netanyahu as well, you know, Qatar is allowed to send money to Gaza, which is just enough to keep Hamas in power and maintain this kind of equilibrium between the two sides. One of the current ministers now, Ben-Gvir, back when he was just a member of Knesset, is known for making the statement that when it comes to a two-state solution, the Palestinian Authority is a liability, but Hamas is an asset. So this is what Israel looks like under Netanyahu. I'll talk about the covert cooperation that picks up in the year 2006, which I identify as like the beginning of this convergence. In 2007, the year after that, the UAE begins to acquire Israeli technology for an internal traffic management system. That same year, it cooperates with an Israeli firm to procure satellite data on Iran's nuclear program. This is done through two satellite systems, the RSA and the RSB. In 2010, the UAE starts pitching to host the headquarters of IRENA, the International Renewable Energy Agency, which is a multilateral agency on renewable energy. And it again engages in conversations with Israeli officials and confirms to them that they'll be allowed to attend events in the UAE as long as they don't block the UAE's case for obtaining the mandate to host IRENA in the UAE. So again, it's this perception that you know, the UAE can get a lot of Washington or even internationally with Israeli support. At the same time, the UAE also asks Israeli officials for assistance in making the case for the UAE to acquire civilian nuclear technology from the United States. And this is another key point of engagement between the two sides around the year 2010. Prior to Obama's signing of the Iran nuclear deal, the UAE engages in joint lobbying with Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Israel to convince Obama's officials to take a tougher stance on Iran and its nuclear program. And this is documented pretty extensively in WikiLeaks, actually. So prior to this period, they're really trying to push Obama to take a tougher stance. All of this happens in the lead up to the Trump administration. Sorry, but I have a little bit of a sore throat, so I have to keep drinking water. All of this happens in the lead up to the Trump administration. When Trump is elected to power for the first term, his administration really do enable and accelerate this convergence between the two sides. And I think much of it happens out of the advisors that Trump surrounds himself with. It's not really that, in my view, Trump is necessarily that committed to Israel, but his advisors certainly were committed to Israel. One of them is David Friedman. Friedman was formerly Trump's lawyer. Early on, he becomes Trump's advisor in the campaign, and he shapes the Republican Party platform on Israel and Palestine. He throws out previous language endorsing a two-state solution, which had been a point of bipartisan consensus. Instead, he replaces that with language criticizing UNRWA for being anti-Semitic. He himself is heavily pro-Israeli. He's the head of an organization that fundraised for illegal settlements, and he becomes ambassador to Israel. Jared Kushner, as well, is somebody that really pushes pro-Israel policies in the Trump administration. His family are long-term friends of Prime Minister Netanyahu. There's a story in his biography about him being evicted from his bedroom as a teenager in order to make room for Netanyahu to come and stay over the summer. Mike Pompeo, as well, is appointed Secretary of State. He becomes the first Secretary of State to visit a settlement in Israel. And, I mean, having read perhaps more than I cared to his officials, what's interesting from Pompeo and Friedman, particularly in Friedman's biography, is their use of divine language to justify Trump's presence as a president. Both speak about Trump being sent possibly from God to protect the state of Israel, and they really see themselves as on this kind of divine mission to do God's work. Very early on in the administration, Trump's advisors tell him that the Palestinians don't want peace, that they're the beneficiaries of much international aid, and they don't want to change the status quo, and they really shouldn't be dealt with at all. Instead, they push the president to adopt very pro-Israel policies, and a series of them. These include moving the embassy to Jerusalem. They include walking back on the Hansel Memorandum, which is a U.S. position that settlements were illegal. And so he rolls this back in consultation with a team of Israeli lawyers that are friendly to Netanyahu. He cuts aid to UNRWA, the president does, the Palestinian Refugee Agency, which is a long-time goal of Netanyahu's. And all of this together leads to a boycott from the Palestinians. Nonetheless, Kushner is interested in developing a legacy and wants to be, you know, sort of the person who resolves the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So he puts together, along with other advisors, a plan for resolving the conflict. And this gets delayed at several junctures, partly because Netanyahu is running for re-election and it's just not the right time to release this kind of plan. But eventually it does get released in two components, as an economic peace plan and a political peace plan. And from the beginning, the Palestinians decline to participate and say this administration is heavily against us and we don't want to have anything to do with this plan. So what happens is that rather than bring the two sides together, it's the Gulf states that get drawn into this process. When the economic components of the peace plan is released, it's released in Bahrain, actually, during a kind of a hot summer evening. And drawing the Gulf states into this marks a change from the past. And partly, if I go through some of the components, when the political component does eventually get released, this is the second part of it, it enables Israel to annex one-third of the West Bank. It proposes land swaps for the Palestinians, so instead of territory in the West Bank, what they are offered is land in the Sinai Desert. And the Gulf states are identified as some of the main parties, along with various hedge funds, that are going to fund some of this, including high-speed rails connecting Sinai and the West Bank. In exchange for this, the Palestinians don't get a state, but they get a freeze on settlement construction for a few years, during which they can decide whether they want to continue talks or not. So this is rejected, of course, by the Palestinians, but at the same time, as these plans are being unrolled, in fact, the day that the political component is unrolled, Netanyahu announces his plan to annex the West Bank. And there's a lot of frustration from the Trump administration. I mean, not that their plan doesn't include annexation, but that Netanyahu's annexation is larger than the one proposed by the Trump administration, takes up more land to annex, and it takes place outside any kind of settlement or any framework of a settlement. As Netanyahu is threatening to annex, and I mean, this causes, the Trump administration is pretty split on this. I think figures like Kushner are unhappy with it. Friedman is, of course, happy to go along with pretty much anything. So as this is kind of unraveling, the UAE steps in, and the Emirati ambassador to Washington publishes an editorial in one of Israel's main newspapers, and he says annexation is not acceptable, but he also dangles the possibility of peace by saying countries like the UAE and Israel have more in common than they have differences. And as the pandemic is kind of going on and Netanyahu is threatening to annex him, and this threat partly comes out of his pandering to very right-wing settlement groups, which he needs in order to win the election. Avi and Kushner travel to Israel at that point to convince him not to go ahead. But Netanyahu is pretty determined, at least in his rhetoric, to annex. And that's when they begin to think of an alternative scheme. And they call El Ateba and say, what about normalization? What about normalization between Israel and the UAE in exchange for Netanyahu stopping annexation or foregoing annexation? And this becomes the basis of the agreement. The idea didn't come out of nowhere. El Ateba had previously mentioned to Kushner that the UAE would be interested in normalizing, but I think this becomes a very convenient vehicle for it to take place, and that's exactly what happens. And that tweet gets published, and that's the beginning. I want to talk about what these agreements have accomplished. There's been a lot in the way of trade ties. So trade between the UAE and Israel especially reached $1 billion in their first year and $2 billion in their second year. In the first year, a free trade agreement was signed between the two sides, removing tariffs on over 90% of traded goods. Much of trade is in diamonds and all kinds of goods that can be re-exported. But much of the trade is also centered on delivering Israeli tech to the UAE. This in particular is driven by massive investments by the UAE's sovereign wealth funds and Israeli technology companies. So some of the biggest Emirati sovereign wealth funds start pouring in a lot of money into Israeli firms, and that becomes a bulk of the trade between the two sides, or trade value. It takes more than a year for the security aspect of these agreements to come to light. So in the first year or year and a half, there's really no talk of security or defense. And I think to me that really basically comes out of the UAE's desire to de-escalate with Iran. At the time, the UAE is also interested in not antagonizing Iran and escalating hostilities. And so it downplays any security cooperation with Israel. The rhetoric is really about peace, prosperity, and tolerance. But in January 22, the UAE is hit by several missile attacks suspected from Houthi groups in Yemen, and that's the moment when the defense aspect of the relationship really comes to the surface. As a result of that attack, the UAE acquires two missile defense systems from Israel, including the Barak system. They had asked for Iron Dome, but Iron Dome was not approved. But it does receive these missile defense systems. I think for Bahrain especially, there's been a reputational aspect to the Abraham Accords, which has been useful. Since the Arab Spring, Bahrain has been accused in Washington of sectarianism towards its Shia population, and it's been really fighting to show that it's not sectarian or doesn't have these policies. The Accords have been very useful because Bahrain has effectively conflated normalization with tolerance towards the Jewish people and really used that to improve its image in Washington. So there's been that reputational benefit, I think, particularly for Bahrain. In the United States, there's been a bipartisan push to deepen cooperation between the normalizing states and Israel. And I was speaking to a colleague earlier who was making the point that, you know, in the year or two after normalization, everything in the US, every conversation you'd have, would have to have an element about the Abraham Accords or normalization. And I agree. I think that's still partly true. The US is there's a bipartisan excitement around this. And I think a goal to draw these states, these Sunni Arab Gulf states, into a new regional security architecture. And there have been concrete steps to make this happen. So one of them was moving Israel from the European zone of command into CENTCOM, which encompasses all the Arab states. And this has enabled Israel to advance its security cooperation not only with the normalizing states, but with those that don't have relations with it under the umbrella of CENTCOM. Biden very much continued on the path set out by Trump. He made normalization with Saudi Arabia a key pillar of Middle East policy. We heard nothing from him about resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which was totally relegated as irrelevant. Within the Gulf itself, I would say there was some trepidation towards normalization. If you look at popular polls and data on the topic, I think initially the moment after the accords were signed, there was some optimism, certainly, that maybe this can lead somewhere positive. But the 2021 Israel-Gaza attacks, that brief period of hostilities kind of pushed numbers down, and of course October 7th pushed them even further down to a very, really low numbers. We can see this in tourism as well. So in the first 2 years of relations, 450,000 Israeli tourists visited the UAE, which is massive, 500,000 out of a population of 7 million. By comparison, the numbers of Emiratis and Bahrainis visiting Israel is much lower. It was, according to Israel's Ministry of Tourism, 3,600 Emiratis in the first 2 years, and the numbers of Bahrainis were too small to mention. So the Gaza war on October 7th, I think, has chilled but not derailed normalization. There's been massive public outrage towards Israel's actions after the war, some protests, but I think where you can really see opposition is in the boycott movement that is taking place across the Gulf. When asked, 71% of Saudi citizens said that they were engaged or supportive of this boycott. 96% believed that all Arab states, should cut ties with Israel in response to the war. So it's a huge number. I'll just wrap up because of time. But I think if we can think about several kind of themes or conclusions, I talk about the limits of normalization in the book. And what I mean by that is that these agreements have not addressed or did little to kind of lead to the resolution of the core conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. In fact, their entire logic, the entire premise of the Abraham Accords is based on the sidelining of the conflict and built on a fatigue of diplomacy, not only in the Arab states and in Israel, but also in the US, where really the goal of expanding normalization has effectively replaced the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as the main focus of US policy towards the region. The consequence of this is the entrenchment of the conditions that gave rise to the October 7th attacks and Israel's reprisal. There's also the democracy angle. the idea that normalization rests on a lack of democracy in the Arab world. These are unpopular agreements, and they're only sustained because citizens don't have a choice. I think they also show us a lot about the fracturing of the old Arab order, the decline of Arab nationalism, and they also shatter this, I think what we've seen now is, with October 7th, an end to this myth that Israel can maintain its occupation without consequence for its own security. But it's also shattered the myth that the region can just forget about this conflict and move on and move forward. We're seeing the cost of that way of thinking today. What's needed is the right kind of diplomacy, not oriented towards the expansion of normalization, but diplomacy to resolve the conflict at hand in a final way and holistic way that serves the interests of justice for both sides.
Thank you very much for the
talk.
So I'm going to start with a couple of questions.
Yes.
I guess the one question I had while opening the book was, I mean, it's a silly question, but
no.
why the Abraham Accord? Who had the perverse idea to call these the Abraham Accord?
It's a great question, actually, and it's mentioned in one of their biographies, I think Kushner's biography. They were sitting down right before the announcement was made by a day or two and thinking about what to call them. And then a general came in, like walked in through the door, and they posed the question to him, and he said, how about the Abraham Accords? Because those involved are all of the Abrahamic faith, and this brings together two of the major Abrahamic faiths. And then they thought that was a brilliant idea and went with it. So like much of what happens, I think reading these biographies of Trump's officials, so much of it is spur of the moment. So much of it is, a personal kind of thing that happens. Someone has an idea, someone else says something, and it's executed. And so that's exactly what happened.
All right. Do we have the name of that general?
I can get it for you. I definitely can get it for you.
My other question is, you mentioned those polls at the end of your talk,
yeah.
And I was, listening to you, I was thinking about domestic politics in the GCC countries,
yeah.
And also of how much of a difference there is between, the 1973 embargo,
yeah.
and the fact that King Faisal was really not only out of his own convictions,
yeah.
But also responding to,
yeah.
to what he perceived was very strong current in Saudi public opinion. Right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
So moving forward 50 years later, right before October 7th,
yeah.
there is it's a massive shift, right? So how do you? I guess there are several layers to that question, right? I mean, what do you think is happening right now in terms of public opinions in the Gulf that basically emboldens Gulf rulers and Gulf leaders to side with Israel I'm talking about again before October 7th.
Yeah.
And then the other layer is. I think it's in the book that you talked about it a little bit in the talk, the Israel washing of authoritarianism, right?
Mm.
And how you may kill Khashoggi, but then if you play nice with the potential idea of one day speaking to Israeli officials, and it might you might think that it's going to be forgotten. At the very same time, when Khaliji Gulf regimes have been using Israeli tools to actually enhance their repression and surveillance of, and I'm thinking of the UAE, using
mm-hmm.
all these digital tools to surveil and repress. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's not a very clear question, but it's really about internal politics. What can you tell us more about what's going on in the various countries and especially in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, sure. So the internal dynamics I think are fairly straightforward, although it may not have appeared so. I think. By 2019, I think the Gulf states were just had Iran on the top of their list. And I think, as I mentioned in the talk, all of the kind of convergence that took place, the relations that took place behind the scenes and the lead up to this, much of this was centered around dealing with Iran, like joint lobbying against Iran or acquiring technology in order to survey Iran. And then there's the domestic element too, which is the spyware sales that we know about, which were intended to sort of as a domestic, for domestic, their own domestic security concerns. And so I think that the driver of this really was kind of this fear of Iran. When it comes to the populations, I think there was a sense that this any kind of upset from the populations could be managed. It could be managed in two ways. It could be managed by selling this as something positive and selling this as something that was in the interest of the Palestinians, which is sort of what happened with the UAE, at least for this brief moment, this idea of we're doing this for the Palestinians and to stop annexation. I think that was a key point that was, you know, made early on as a way of selling this agreement. But the other way to sustain it was to simply just, you know, be aware that, that you could repress any protest that took place. And in Bahrain, that is what happened. There's an element of repression too. I mean, it was COVID, I think, conveniently enough, it was COVID, and so you couldn't have that many protests. But I think there was very much an understanding that if this got too much out of hand, it could be repressed the same way the Arab Spring movements were successfully repressed. And so I think there's a two-part thinking around that. I think you asked me about Saudi Arabia. I don't know if you could be more specific, like, is it about the cost of normalization now, or?
I mean, I guess I'm struck by the, you know, there are parallelism, right, between the Saudi situation, especially since 2015, right,
yeah.
and what happens between Israel and Palestine,
yeah.
In Israel, Palestine, right? I mean, I'm imagining too much here, but
yeah.
The war in Yemen has been really striking us all as a moment, right? A moment of militarization, of unleashing, you know, violence against thy neighbor, who
yes.
is almost a little more populous than you. I mean, there's that whole demographic dynamics
yeah.
between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, that fear of. So I don't know.
I understand. I think I get what you're trying to get to. Saudi Arabia in those years, kind of post Khashoggi and as the war in Yemen unfolded, got a lot of heat in Washington. I think Saudi Arabia became very isolated in Washington. I think whereas if you think of its previous
mm-hmm.
stature, it was a pretty powerful actor in D.C. There became, and I think the culmination of this was Biden's vow to isolate Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and make him a pariah. I mean, I think that really showed how Saudi Arabia had lost ground in D.C. And by kind of entering this kind of pathway to normalization,
sure.
you can see how Saudi Arabia totally turned it around. It became the renewed focus of the Biden administration. I mean, I think up until October 7th, its main priority was bringing Saudi Arabia into the accords. You had Blinken and others sent there regularly to try and engage in these talks. And a massive turnaround. I think Saudi Arabia, it's interesting to kind of note that it hasn't changed anything really, but by entering this conversation, it managed to completely change its reputation
mm-hmm.
in Washington. You don't hear anything about Saudi Arabia being isolated anymore. I think even with, it's interesting to see like even what Germany has done. So Germany temporarily suspended arms sales to Saudi Arabia after Khashoggi and because of the war in Yemen. And they resumed arms sales, I think around a year ago, citing its favorable attitude towards normalization. So even towards places like Germany, Saudi Arabia has gained a lot by merely entertaining these talks
mm-hmm.
and no more. Yeah.
Thanks. Thanks very much
Thank you.
For coming.